you're listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between. This is the second part of my exploratory conversation with Tim Kay. Tim and I are discussing Morris Berman's Wandering God, a study in nomadic spirituality.
There's a rock inside my chest.
Pick up where we left off. I listened back to podcast yesterday. I edited out a bit at the beginning because it was too much about me. I thought it should start with a bang, and I thought it was very good. I enjoyed listening back to it, so that's always a good sign.
So were there any standouts on listening back to it?
No specific things, like, oh, we need to go more into that. Some more general things which would be very meta, so we could get to that on another occasion if we continue these dialogues. But for now, I think we've got a lot still to get to, don't we?
Yes, we do. Okay, so let's go ahead and dive right in.
So we're at chapter two now, are we?
Right, chapter two, Politics and Power. So there's really nothing at the beginning of the chapter that stands out particularly for me, except page 52, the section on delayed versus immediate return.
Page 52, okay. So yeah, I don't have anything until page 58, so go ahead, lead the way.
Okay, so let's see, what's the thing here? Okay, so on page 53, the paragraph at the bottom, Berman goes into, we're still looking at hunter-gatherer societies, but then he gets into mode of production for them. So he says here, quote, immediate return systems reject the notion of a surplus. Tribes such as the Hadza, the Kung, and the Mubuti Pygmies of Zaire, which has now gone by another name, do not accumulate property. In such societies, even if you don't participate in a particular hunt, you have the right to eat, and individual hunters have no future claims on those they feed. One is not constrained by group decisions, and these societies either have no leaders or have leaders who wield no coercive power. Delayed return societies, which are based on the accumulation of surplus, inevitably lose their egalitarianism. There is a preferred status for those who arrange and manage the surplus for the rest of the tribe. Such systems also create dependency on specific persons so that one is caught up in a network of binding ties and corporate groups that can determine one's survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot there. I mean, even the idea of delayed return versus immediate return economies / societies was new to me, at least, just the terminology and it being really a central factor in the way that communities organize themselves and experience themselves, and then the deeper level, like the ramifications for that in terms of perceptions and philosophies and all the rest of it. But that passage that you just zeroed in on is very specific. I mean, it's very obviously politically relevant, which is part of why it's in the chapter called Politics and Power, obviously.
So let's go to the next page, page 44.
Okay.
He says in the last paragraph, central to the immediate return economy, or at least the necessary condition for it, is the phenomenon of movement. Movement works heavily against any tendencies towards surplus building and accumulation, which suggests that sedentism is a key factor in the origins of social inequality. In addition, the nomadic life is one that acts as a natural leveler of social conflict, which becomes a major issue once human beings start to create permanent settlements.
Okay.
Anything that stands out for you there?
Oh, what made you single it out?
Well, he's going back to what he covered in the first chapter with movement. So the hunter-gatherers' key to their existence was moving from place to place. They didn't stay in one place, which is what sedentism is. So I can draw upon personal experience, and I'm sure lots of other people can, is that it's much easier to disengage from something that is exploitative or harmful to you if you can do so. But if you can't, that presents a problem. However, the thing about sedentism, and I think he nails it in the one sentence, is a key factor in the origins of social inequality. So if you're stuck and hierarchies develop, then, as we just touched on, that increases the likelihood that you could be taken advantage of and exploited by someone else, unless you just pack up and leave.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm sure the primitive societies, when this was starting to spread, you know, like in the case of the U.S., if you didn't like it on the East Coast back in the 19th century, you could just go west. You escaped it. And then you struck out on your own. Now that's far more difficult to do because most of it is colonized, as is a lot of the world. And even there are some places where you could go to just try to get away from it all where you're not going to survive, like the desert.
I mean, I'm kind of in that situation currently in terms of wanting to move from one continent to the other and how difficult it is to pull up stakes and move. And I'm not trying to move because I'm being exploited. But just in terms of, I mean, the advantages of sedentary life are many, starting from this thing of agriculture to what you're saying, that you establish connections and you own a community or within a community, a support network. But that the very nature of that support network, as we've just hopefully laid out briefly, is that there's more opportunity for exploitation. It's kind of no-brainer, isn't it? It's if you depend on individuals for your livelihood, then you are potentially vulnerable. You're vulnerable to being exploited by that. If you have a landlord, he can, unless there's rent control laws, he can put the rent up, you know, even though you can't afford to, because he knows that it's too difficult for you to move and find another place, and so on. There's a number of different ways in which that plays out. And so I mean, it occurred to me, speaking from personal experience, that I spent most of my life from my 20s to the age of, until the age of 40, moving. And first of all, that was possible because I had money. So I just went off to New York and was like, well, I can do anything I want. I can go anywhere I want. But interesting enough, I found out I only had money for those 6 years between 18 and 24 because I gave up my inheritance at 24 and I went off to Morocco. And I didn't stop traveling as a thing. And what I found when I was experiencing poverty and homelessness was what you're saying, that it's much easier to just keep on moving because the opportunities that one finds in any given place, well, they don't necessarily last that long unless you're going to lay down roots, and I wasn't doing that. So you don't want to, you know, you run out of favors, put simply, or if you're stealing, you know, eventually people recognize you as a thief. If you're begging and so on, right? There are various obstacles to staying in the same place. Whereas moving, yeah, you've constantly got, I suppose, like grazing for a cow, isn't it? Or indeed the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, nomad. You're constantly going to more fertile ground, right? Even at this base social level, as in I was begging and stealing and looking for home, you know, buildings I could sleep in and so on, before the police kicked me out and what have you, or mooching. I mean, I didn't do much mooching. But it was interesting, and it was surprising me to discover that, how poverty was conducive with nomadism and vice versa. Well, let's go back to the text so that we don't creep too far from it.
Sure. Okay, so skipping ahead, he goes to page 63 in section about the role of population pressure.
Hold on. I think you've gone ahead of me now because I got something on page 58.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll just have to read it because I'm not sure how much of it is going to be relevant, but I can always cut it out if it isn't. From a modern point of view, hunter-gatherer societies would seem to be apolitical. What Clastres argues is that such a viewpoint is the bias of a culture that equates politics with the state. From the viewpoint of Western ethnography, in other words, power is identical to coercion or violence. It is the ability to channel the behavior of others by threat or use of sanctions. A society that doesn't operate on such a basis is, in our terms, regarded as a society without power. Yet, throughout Mexico as well as Central and South America, Clastres argues, there have been and still are Indian or native societies headed by caciques who do not possess power in the classical Western sense. As Clastres put it, no relationship of command-obedience is enforced. The notion that coercion, subordination, and hierarchy constitute the essence of political power in all times and all places is merely the bias of vertically organized cultures. It is for this reason that the first European explorers felt psychologically at home in the Mexico of the Aztecs or the Peru of the Incas. These empires wielded power in the way that people from monarchic nations understood it. But when the same explorers encountered, for example, the Tupinamba Indians of Paraguay, they were completely disoriented, describing them as people without God, law, and king. From the very beginning, says Clastres, our ethnography has been skewed. We have taken our own definition of power as the yardstick of meaning and then gone out into the field to see how stateless societies measure up. What we find is a lack, when what we are really doing is displaying our own conceptual poverty. What this approach misses is the political achievement of those cultures that practice the power of non-power, because from the outside it looks like nothing. And in a sense it is nothing. But as Clastres shows, this is a very rich nothing, a nothing which, like the empty hand of karate, actually contains enormous power. And continue on page 60. The prestige of the chief in those kinds of communities is closely bound up with his generosity, but this is in effect a kind of bondage. Rather than having power in our sense, the chief is in a constant state of obligation. Across all of South America, says Clastres, greed and power are incompatible. Having a chief who has no coercive power, the tribe displaces power from the center to the periphery. It exists, but no one can find it. These tribes, says Clastres, have an intuitive understanding that allowing power to be vested in a person conceals a mortal risk for the group and is a challenge to culture itself. So what they did was create a paradoxical way of neutralizing the potential threat of the coercive model. They chose themselves to be the founders of that authority, writes Clastres, but in such a manner as to let power appear only as a negativity which is immediately subdued. In other words, by having a chief whose power is effectively nothing, the group displays its radical rejection of authority. By refusing coercion as an option, this choice on the part of the tribe becomes intentional.
Okay, so there's a long passage here that I think is quite illustrative. It's on page 68. So he's on the prior page, this is the section of biological basis to egalitarianism, and he's talking about an experiment with chimpanzees.
Right.
So he says, in 1965, a change was instituted that made the existence of fluid independent communities impossible, the chimp communities, and what resulted was total bedlam. A new system was that of human-controlled banana feeding, which fostered direct competition among the Gombe chimps for limited food. It involved making the chimps waiting groups for the food to be released, introducing elements of temporal uncertainty, irregularity, and population clustering. The result was a sharp increase in the number of aggressive interactions. In fact, the whole foraging social order broke down, and the chimps began to kill each other. What rapidly evolved was a ranked society, with great emphasis on territoriality. By 1972, groups of apes began patrolling the peripheries of their home range, brutally attacking the outsiders they encountered. The year before, one group of chimps had left the Gombe area and moved south. This was known as the Kahama group. The ones that remained were the Kasakala group. Between 1971 and 76, the Kasakala males sought out and killed all of the members of the Kahama group. These are dramatic events, and it is a pity, as Margaret Power notes, that reports on and from Gombe argue for innate territoriality, hierarchy, and aggression, when chimp behavior prior to 1965 clearly contradicts this. Change things such as food supplies, population densities, and the possibilities for spontaneous group formation and dissolution, and all hell breaks loose. no less for apes than for humans. If people or chimps want community, they want it on their own terms, not under conditions of obligation and dependency. However, this does not amount to an every man for himself society. Banned societies are based on sharing, on the allocation of goods and services without calculating the returns. Sharing may be closely related to our biological nature, rooted in the mothering of children by adults. Because it is based on intimate linkages and biosocial attributes, it doesn't work for large populations. When it hits the, quote, public sector, that is, goes much beyond band-level society, it is transformed into a system of redistribution. All of this suggests that our natural propensity is at least partly egalitarian, but not especially communitarian. Band societies are nomadic. They value individual autonomy, and they do not form person-specific economic dependencies. For the most part, the Kung, example notwithstanding, conflict is not resolved by working things out, but by throwing in the towel. All of this suggests that community, at least as understood within the conceptual framework of the last 10,000 years, is unnatural. The basic model for human relations is the family, and this cannot be extended much beyond 25 or 30 people. As population growth creates population density in circumscribed areas, all manner of attempts are made to reduce conflict. But the biological basis for, quote, getting along is very weak. This is where hierarchy enters the picture. And I have a note in the margin about the Dunbar number. You're familiar with that?
No.
So Robin Dunbar, who is a British anthropologist from some years ago, he coined what's called the Dunbar number, which is about 150 people. This is the number beyond which it becomes difficult to keep everybody straight in one's mind and one's cognitive architecture and the ideal size of a society, of a group.
It came up on a podcast recently, I think. Might have been with Kunstler.
Yeah, I think he's talked about that before too. It's a helpful thing to keep in mind, and underscoring what he's talked about here is I like really what he focuses on, communitarian. So that definitely has seemed to be the case in the Western world for a long time, is that yes, it's just a wider community because we're all part of the nation. We're all French or German or whatever it is. But it doesn't seem to work past the group because it always seems to default back to the family, the immediate family and the extended family, which is a much smaller group than is the nation.
Trusting, pressing, pushing, making.
One of the most comprehensive studies undertaken in this subject is that of Brian Hayden and Robert Gargett, who did original fieldwork among communities of the Maya area of Mesoamerica. These communities, which had been extremely isolated in the early 20th century, experienced a series of crises during that time. Interviews conducted with older individuals who had lived through these events produced independent testimony that was unequivocal. Incipient elites, or what the authors call accumulators, provided no aid to their communities other than actions designed to consolidate their own power and wealth. Across the board, the accumulators made usurious loans, sold food at very high prices, and bought children to work as servants or slaves. In other words, emergence of elites was strictly a response to the opportunistic possibilities for self-aggrandizement. And the authors argued that this is the norm, that all human populations contain individuals with competitive, acquisitive personalities who try to rise to the top. Accumulators everywhere, they write, appear to be primarily skilled manipulators of social relationships, production, and debts. But then he continues, all of this is very revealing, but even if we do solve the problem of what motivates some individuals to seek power, we are left with a problem that is equally significant for our inquiry, namely, what enables them to get away with it? Why does the rest of the community submit? Assuming egalitarianism were the norm, say Hayden and Gargett, how then does the process leading to a socioeconomic inequality even get started? How is it possible for a few individuals to persuade the vast majority of the community to moderate or even abandon rigid egalitarian ethics, to give up communal access to any important resources, and to let a few individuals exert disproportionate influence on the decisions and behavior of the majority of the community? Hayden and Gargett attempt to answer this with an appeal to cultural ecology and natural selection. But for me, at least, this won't work, because it is only a restatement of the argument that opportunistic behavior gets triggered when the material conditions are right, which, although true, still begs the question. More relevant is Marvin Harris's remark that the desire of the big man for prestige is actually the search for a love substitute.
Right. Yeah, that was a line that I incorporated into 16 Maps of Hell at the end. It's definitely a key to the whole thing. The question they're asking really there is it really that different than the question of the origin of evil? Do you think? Is it sort of flattened out and more socially acceptable equivalent to that question? Like, where, how did things go wrong? How did this element emerge in human life that ruined everything, or seems to have trying to ruin everything?
Right. Well, Berman makes the point, I think it's a transcendental one, is that it's easy to say that, quote, evil is within all of us, and all we need is a certain trigger, material conditions, poverty, crime, or things like that. But it really doesn't explain how evil got in there in the first place.
Exactly.
So yeah. This is where one could take issue with the Marxists, and the Marxists would say somewhat simplistically that it's all about economic conditions. But is it real?
Right. No, it doesn't make any sense. It's, it's the question of who created God comes to mind. I mean, if you're going to posit an original cause, it better be transcendental, because economic systems were created by human beings.
Right. Right. Or if it's even biological, then why does it exist in the first place?
Yeah, it's biological. It's got to be natural.
Right. A survival mechanism? Okay. But what else? Is it really just a survival mechanism? Or could it be, you know, we talked at length about trauma before, is it was put there, you could say. Or that it's maybe a natural outgrowth of something that the infant suffers from the very beginning.
And this is what part of how I've been drawn to Christianity, or how I found the myths of Christianity useful, or the doctrine, is it does answer this question of the origin of evil in storytelling form. And then Girard, of course, has expanded on it in many different ways, and rooted it in something psychological and sociological. I have to pause there because I'm not sure where I was going with that.
What exactly did Girard say about that?
Well, he writes about and refers to
the scapegoat.
Well, the scapegoat mechanism, so Cain and Abel, and then Joseph, and then Christ. And mimetic rivalry and mimetic violence. And the need to dispel that through sacrifice. So, but I have to, I mean, I was, this is such a, that's why I brought up the origin of evil, because it's such a huge question that it is tempting to either revert to mythological thinking or to say it's a mystery, you know, to take the Catholic line and just say it's a mystery, that's with God, right? Whereas we're trying to talk about something in a way that we're kind of problem solving, aren't we? And so eventually we're going to end up with the ultimate problem, which is what has been branded evil, what separates us from God or our natural essence. And then we get this potentially tautological circular thing of, well, is it evil or sin or trauma that separates us from our essence, or is it separation from our essence that brings about evil or that is traumatizing, right? Back the gap and alienation, is it the gap that alienates us, or is it alienation that creates the gap? There seems to be a certain point where it doesn't quite make sense. It's paradox, isn't it? And that's in the story of the Garden of Eden, because, and in the whole Christian doctrine, because if God created creation in such a way that the serpent was in there too, and if God, who is omniscient, allowed the serpent, it's in the book of Job, you know, God just gives the thumbs up to Satan and says, yeah, do what thou wilt with him, you know, have fun with him, and we'll see. So there's a cooperation between God and the devil, God and the serpent, and very least a complicity that's inescapable in there, which doesn't allow for a real dichotomy, as in we had pristine perfect existence and then something came in from outside and ruined it, which is the most tempting way to look at it. But the problem with that is we end up with this unknown outside, like what is it? Is there something outside of existence that somehow made it into existence? That's oxymoronic, just as something that acts independently of the will of God is oxymoronic, although of course human beings have free will, but that doesn't really make much sense either, not really. So with trauma, it's back to the family unit, I think, which is, and I haven't thought this before, but something in our childhood experience interjects itself and destroys trust. There's some sort of betrayal that occurs, and whether that's the betrayal of a parent who is supposed to be loving the child and doesn't, let's just leave it as broad as possible, doesn't love the child unconditionally, could even be a mother having a thought in the womb like, I don't want to be a mother. It could be as small a thing as that, let's say one negative thought of the mother while the child's in the womb. But anyway, a moment of betrayal in which the love object is no longer giving love, and everything starts going wrong. And so is that coming from inside or outside? Well, it's kind of both, particularly if you're in the womb. And there's going to be a tendency to want to see it as something outside, or it was an uncle, or it was Jimmy Savile, it was just somebody who came from outside and my parents didn't protect me, which is bad enough, but it wasn't actually them. And it, you know, it could well be that, but still, it's still happening on the inside. Even if it comes from the outside, it still had access to the family. And the family isn't a closed unit, just as, well, I mean, nothing is a closed unit except for everything. See what I mean? It's only when we allow for the totality. So I always end up that we have a closed system. So I always end up at this point where one can't really, one can just see that there was a disruption within the system and that it would be better if it wasn't there, and that there's a way to neutralize the disruption. And that somehow it was accumulative. That's all I mean, that's the closest I can get to a semi-satisfactory answer, which is, so with the aggrandizer thing, that there was a tendency in a band of nomads, let's say, or in a part of humanity at large, there was a tendency to contract against difficult situations and then to compensate for that and think, I don't want to feel this bad feeling anymore, so I'm going to act in such a way that will reduce the chances of having this unpleasant experience. There's a tendency in all of us to do that, and if that gets overstimulated in a group and then in an individual, then, and that would kind of be the same thing, if it gets overstimulated in a group, let's say, then it starts getting acted out by individuals in a group, just as in an individual. If our system gets overstimulated, then certain faculties, such as the intellect, get overactive. We start compensating and we start scheming and plotting like Rabbit and Winnie the Pooh, or whoever, obviously, Lex Luthor and many different bad guys, the schemers, to control our nervous system and to control our environment. So it's happening, even if it's happening, even if it's appearing manifest in certain individuals or certain behaviors in an individual, it's happening in the whole group, in the whole body, and in the whole group. So then this is where it gets, I think this is where it keeps coming at a sort of dead end, because I think that, and this probably is, maybe it's in the passage that we read earlier about power. I'm not sure, because I'm really hardly thinking now. I'm just speaking without thinking. But that, and I, so much so that I forgot what I was going to say. There's some inherent paradox. I know I was getting to that. Yeah, I'm gonna stop and let you speak, because I lost whatever it was, but I'm sure it'll come back.
Well, I wanted to return to the text. I don't have too much to say to
Oh, really? You must have something. Come on.
that.
I just laid a hole.
Well, I mean, what you covered before is that, of course, I mean, all of us have experiences that we feel overwhelmed. So then we contract I forget what that insect is that curls up into a ball when it feels it's threatened or under attack. That's what we all do. Some of us
Yeah.
go into overdrive because of things that have happened to us in our past traumas that we've never resolved, and continual stressors that happen too. Like one develops a short temper, it's because you're dealing with unpleasant people all the time, and you have lots of other responsibilities that you're trying to meet, but you just can't do it yourself, and you can't rely on
Yeah.
others. So then you become, I know, I certainly have done that in my life different times, particularly if you're alone, and you're not part of a group where you can diffuse, you can spread out some of the anxiety, and also call upon the other people to come up with a concerted strategy to go at it as a group. You know, this is the thing that I always scratch my head about, where, and I've thought about this off and on over the years, is that, you know, whenever they talk about, well, you know, if the people just banded together, they can do anything. Well, yeah, in theory that's true, but how do you get all the people to band together to think of something beyond themselves and to push back against it? You know, trade unions used to do that, but who belongs to a trade union anymore? A labor union. They could certainly do that, but then do they have a leg to stand on where they fight back against a corporation that is going to take their livelihood away, type of thing? That's all part of a globalized environment where it's easy just to for the corporation to disengage from that. There's no skin in the game. So then they become one of those aggrandizers in an impersonal form that can move from place to place across the globe, and they're not rooted to one place in particular.
I think we're talking about is a failed prototype, and I think that that's where the Book of Genesis and that myth comes in, is that you know, God gave man free will, but then man fucked it up. And I think that that's what's happening is that there's something in the creation which is that man begins in this kind of innocent state with no ego and no self-awareness, and he or we are supposed to or destined to potential. We have the potential to develop a sense of self-awareness without giving into alienation and the despair of that, and so becoming an aggrandizer. In other words, abusing the free will that we've been given. But it's the temptation is so great that we keep failing, and so that I think there's something in this is a natural. I don't like the word evolutionary anymore, but I'll use it anyway. It's a natural evolutionary process, potential process that's happening here or isn't happening, that's being tested out, and so it's, and it has to do with like I was saying, we keep failing with the diagnosis because we keep passing the buck. We keep trying to attribute the problem, the flaw, the evil to something outside, whether it's aggrandizers, whether it's Satan, you know, whether it's reptilians from some other dimension. And the problem with that is, number one, it's untrue, and number two is that it's it stems from and reinforces this original illusion or original projection, I think, that happens when we start to develop self-awareness. We start to think that self-awareness, or we associate or correlate self-awareness with separation from the collective, when in fact it's nothing of the kind. Like, self-awareness doesn't it's not about asserting or establishing separation from the group. It's actually about self-awareness within the group. But somehow that's like straight is the gate and narrow is the way, that's incredibly hard somehow for us to be in that paradox that I am an individual, I am a self who dwells in this body or is or sensing through this body, but I'm also part of a collective. Somehow that paradox is so challenging that we retreat one way or another. We either go back into herd, you know, womb, kind of prenatal subsistence and become dependents, perennial dependents, or we push too far, overcompensate into aggrandizers and become, you know, pathologically driven controllers.
Nor does the society foster that, to say with the paradox.
No, because we have an aggrandizer created society. And I mean, for the longest time, I've had this intuitive sense that the world we're in now, and I call it recently, I think it was with you, a counterfeit world. It's not the real world, it's this counterfeit. It's like a chrysalis around a butterfly. Now, this is a new age thing, so I don't use it much anymore, but I do think that there's some intuitive resonance in it, that we have together created a society and a world that is only supposed to be a what's the word for that, gestation. It's like a chamber for gestation within it, for consciousness to see itself. Maybe I was saying recently, you know, the only way to understand the world in a way that's helpful is to recognize that it's a mirror, and that we're inside something that we've created that is oppressing us, but it's oppressing us for a reason, and that there is something that can break free of that, but only in its own time and not through using will. And so this whole thing about trying to make the world a better place, to me that's like a caterpillar that's dissolving inside a chrysalis, going, oh, you know, I want to decorate the walls of my chrysalis, because, you know, doesn't realize that he's on his way out.
But more simply speaking, what does that better world look like? That's a conceit to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. I want to just quickly go back to nomadism. You talked at length about this. Did you ever get a sense that, I mean, we're talking about sitting with the paradox here. So if I'm an individual operating on my own cognizance and on my own trying to think of the word, but being a nomad and just moving freely among freely within the world. Okay, I'm following my own drum. Okay,
You think at least.
You think at least, and then there are times when you want a sense of community. So then you try to seek out the community, maybe a fellow nomads or something like that, and it's it works for a time, but then those people can come and go as they please. The group dissolves, and then you might have to move along to find another group. I mean, in my own life, I remember when I was in South Korea in the mid-90s teaching English. So that was something that I chose to do. And I was with other teachers in the cities where I was working in. And it was a kind of a self-selecting group, obviously.
Yeah.
But and then they were all there ostensibly for similar reasons. And you're all together, so you meet with each other all the time. But then those people might pick up and leave, or they end their contracts prematurely, or more worrisome is that those same people might have certain pathologies that you were not aware of that are introducing to the group. Like they drink too much, or they smoke, they do drugs, type of thing. You know, that's the danger inherent in having these kind of nomadic groups moving along. You have to in order for the nomadic group to be, I'd say, cohesive, you have to purge any kind of pathologies. I don't know. What's been your sense when you were traveling like that?
Well, I did, okay, you know, sort of stop places for a couple of years, usually never over 2 years, and at least two of those places, Pamplona and Guatemala, I found a tribe. I felt that was what I referred to it back then. I was finding my tribe, particularly in Pamplona. Well, both places, I met people very quickly, and then I met other people through those people, and within a month or 2 months, I felt I had a kind of tribe, and that tribe was centered around. Well, in my mind, it was centered around me, but I was raising narcissists. But I mean, separate from that, kind of possibly separate from that, it was centered around an awareness that there was some destiny we were trying to fulfill and access, some higher destiny. So although we didn't start a cult or build a monastery or anything like that, there was that sense. However, it was also, as you just mentioned, heavily reliant on drugs and alcohol and all that stuff. And so I would say inherently unstable.
That was the glue. That was the glue that kept it together.
It kind of was. And so it had a limited lifespan. And certainly in the case of Pamplona, it ended badly. It ended with a kind of mutual disillusionment and dissolution. And I mean, I would say that we weren't really on the same page. Maybe we thought we were. We had a lot of shared interests, but we certainly didn't have a shared commitment. And I think and this is back to the monastic life and also hunter-gatherer nomad existence. If you know that if a nomad band is partly a band because it's surviving together, you know, it survives better as a group than it would as individuals, then they've got a shared commitment and a shared focus, and ditto in a different way with the monastery, whether it's, as you said, preserving aspects of culture or whatever else. They have worldly tasks, but then they also have this shared dedication to God. We could say self-improvement, but that's a very modern term. I think that's the hard thing to find, that glue that will bind a group together, that is a kind of commitment that is invisible. Your commitment, committing to something that's sort of by its nature, it's intangible, because we're wanting to get closer to our essence of what we are, because we can't actually have a sense of it. And it does seem to be about being able to be in the paradox, even in the specifics of. I think actually one of the cruxes is when you and this wouldn't have been the case for the nomads, I don't suppose, in ancient times, maybe it was, but when you have a gathering, when you create or enter into a group, inevitably you start to reenact family dynamics. And so it's really essential to be autonomous within a group in such a way that one isn't repeating the same kind of patterns of dependency that lead to the same patterns of betrayal that one experienced as a child, which are compelling one into seeking something in a group.
Right. They're trying to escape from something by going into the other group.
Or to give benefit, they might be trying to resolve it, and it can resolve by reenacting, but it can also just screw everything up terribly. Just
Yeah, that I certainly noticed that among the teachers I met when I was in Korea is some of them were doing it just for a year, something different to do. Maybe they were taking a gap year from college or university and then going back, a change of scenery. Or in the case of this one woman I worked with at the one university, she was in the late 50s and she kind of was trying to escape from something. Of course, she this was one of my first encounters way back in the day about somebody who was clearly traumatized, because she told me about her background and that she was divorced, where her husband had to try to have her committed to an institution, drove her crazy type of things, you know. So she was seeking some kind of resolution. Plus, she was a Seventh-day Adventist, so she I think she was trying to reconcile some of those things by studying Buddhism, what she understood as Buddhism in Korea, even though a lot of Koreans are evangelical Christians, not Buddhists to the same extent as Japanese are. So this was my first introduction of just people who are interesting, but at the same time strange. Interesting because they are not the norm, but the strange is because what's motivating them. And unfortunately, it seems more often than not there's some pathology there that is motivating them.
Well, I don't know this person, but I would say that in my experience, so if somebody's interesting, they're probably going to be strange, and they're probably going to be motivated by, to some degree, by some core dissatisfaction. I mean, you spent half your life reading philosophy books. There must have been something driving that.
Ears to know.
The urge to know. Yeah, but and
Also, to a certain extent, self-understanding.
what I mean is there must have been some dissatisfaction
Sure,
driving it.
sure. Dissatisfaction with what my upbringing was, and as I became an adult. I think that's the case for a lot of people. Once they become a young adult, and they're seeking. They then become externally focused until around age 40 to take the Jungian track when they start to focus more inwards.
Yeah.
I got a nine pound tambourine. I got a nine pound bullet to tambourine. I'm gonna ring it in the bullet to tambourine.
Yeah, well, on that point of knowledge, I definitely have lots to say, but I also am aware I'd like to complete chapter two today, at least. So where's your next annotation?
Okay, so let's go ahead and skip
one page, because I've got one on page 76.
Okay, you do 76. I think it might be the same one.
It could be. Yeah. All of the anthropological data we have supports the notion that cultures with immediate return economies tend to entertain charismatic behavior largely under conditions of stress. Otherwise, the focus is on this life. The sacred is merely what is present in front of them. Such cultures do not generate prophets or guru figures. Worship is simply participation in the here and now. This is difficult to do in the context of a delayed return economy.
Same one.
It was the same one. Yeah. And we've converged at last.
Yes, we have. So we could skip to page 78. Kind of continuing the same point, Berman says, hierarchy, competition, and belief in spirits and witchcraft all arose together. Paradox and egalitarianism are extremely fragile flowers. It doesn't take much for religious and political hierarchy to overwhelm them. Sedentism, of course, increases the amount of community life that is forced on the individuals involved. We have already seen that conflict and hierarchy arise in situations of newly imposed sedentism and greater population density. Yeah. And at the same is true with respect to religious behavior. And then on the next page, 79, he says, a drift towards religious verticality and its relationship to political hierarchy is well known and well documented by scholars the world over. The consensus is that sanctified charismatic leadership is a universal feature of the early state, that ceremonialism and shamanism were in proportion to the need to control large groups, that ritual, the codification of myth and legend, the elaboration of symbolism, and the manufacture of prestige goods are the roots of civilization, and so on.
Mm. Anything bubbling up for you?
Rings true to me. They all arose together. Yes, paradox and egalitarianism are extremely fragile. And in particular, sedentism, of course, increases the amount of community life that is forced on the individuals involved. So if you're stuck in one place, the culture envelops you, whether you like it or not. Because if you don't like it, there's no way to escape, really, unless you hit the road. But then you become a nomad, and you're exposed to the elements, as it were.
Right. Yeah, well, I think that was probably one of the things that was motivating me to travel a lot, was not simply or so much to explore or get to know other cultures, but to disengage from the culture that I was born in, to have something to contrast it with, to become less cultured in a way. I mean, because one could say one's becoming more cultured if one is getting to know other cultures, but I was never particularly interested in that. But I was definitely interested in trying to get to the truth of myself. This is what you said about your philosophy reading. So for me, traveling, I think, was a way to... I mean, it literally was, in the sense where I went to make my initial... Well, my first travel was to New York to try and become a successful Hollywood thing, and that, obviously, that was a false start. The next one was a false start in other ways, but much less so, was when I traveled to Oaxaca, Mexico, after reading Castaneda, to seek knowledge, special knowledge, forbidden knowledge, or secret knowledge. So in a literal way, I was trying to, you know, find the truth by going to Mexico, but I think in a less conscious way, as when a couple of years later I went to Morocco, to Africa, it was about actually putting myself in this increasingly strange cultures so that I would be the strange one, and that I wouldn't be able to refer to this cultural mirror that I'd gazed in for my whole life. So it was Really, it's almost like a quest for alienation, ironically, paradoxically.
Yes, I was going to say, in your travels, did you ever get a sense that you were becoming feral?
A little bit. In Morocco, when I was, you know, with a filthy butthole and clothes I hadn't changed in 2 weeks, and just, you know, looking for food and fighting off Moroccans, and it was the closest I got, really. But certainly it was the most alienated time of my life, unless, I mean, there's the lonely in the crowd phenomenon, as in one could be among one's loved ones and feel horribly alienated because one can't connect. But in a really visible, tangible sense, I chose to go to Morocco because I wanted to go to somewhere where I would be badly treated, where I would be despised and reviled, not because I was a masochist, but because I felt I needed something that would stimulate my survival impulse, because otherwise I thought I might self-destroy, I might go under.
You also needed the tonic from your upbringing.
Well, yes, it was all inseparable from getting rid of the money and going somewhere without telling anyone where I was, so people couldn't even think about me. Really, it was a desperate attempt, you know, desperate means for desperate circumstances to extricate myself from my cultural history.
Yes, becoming feral. Interesting. Never had the desire to do that.
No, well, I didn't, you know, I didn't work it out, and I didn't know I had that desire. It was, as I say, desperate circumstances. I just didn't know what else to do. It was actually an alternative to suicide.
Yeah. Okay, well, back to the text. I wanted to go back to page 79, to the last paragraph on the page. He says, "We have already observed that community bonding beyond the level of the family, say 25 or 30 people, is unnatural, and that under population pressure and resource stress, complexity emerges as the easiest way to control the inevitable conflicts. Given what we have said about vertical sacrality, it becomes clear why it too would be adaptive in these circumstances. Trance, in particular, is binding energy, and for the most part, it and the sacred authority complex are not particularly adaptive when hunter-gatherers are not sedentary or circumscribed, that is, penned in by circumstances like geographic circumstances, and can freely make use of fission and fusion option. When fission and fusion is no longer possible, vertical sacred relationships come forward and serve as a homeostatic buffer, in much the same way that social inequality does. This is why the two patterns, the sacred and the secular, mesh so well. Unitive trance keeps communities together that ordinarily wouldn't stay together, and it serves to validate the hierarchy at the same time. In addition, magical systems arise to provide certainty, while ritual serves to reinforce group participation and hierarchies. In this context, charisma makes sense. It is attributed to those who establish ascendancy over others, either by force or by an inner state, which either way amounts to vertical power relations."
Right. There's a lot. There's an awful lot in there, and I'm not able to articulate what it's bringing up just yet, so I'm going to carry on either listening or reading. I have somewhere on page 81. Do you have anything before that?
Well, let me go to page 80, a couple things. So he says in the next paragraph, "Failure to understand the nature and long history of paradox can lead to some very warped assessments regarding the nature of vertical religious experience." And then further down the page, he says that religion is adaptive in a warped context doesn't make it a positive thing. All of this is, in my view, a good demonstration of how far we have strayed from what it really is natural. Okay, so what do you have on 81?
On 81 I have, in the song lines, Bruce Chatwin argues that movement is not only a leveling mechanism, something that prevents the emergence of social inequality, but also something that is central to nomadic consciousness, to human fulfillment, and that serves to make life so rich here on earth that there was no need for many or most hunter-gatherers to create religion or concepts of an afterlife. Wandering, says Chatwin, re-establishes an original harmony, read paradox, that existed between human beings and the universe. He argues that it is an instinctive migratory urge, something we carry with us in a genetic or inherent sense. It is precisely the nomadic, i.e. ambulatory, aspect of hunter-gatherer life that sustains the perception of paradox and the fluidity of mind that was lost when the human race sat down. The hunter-gatherer way of life, with its evolutionary basis in movement and animal alertness, adds up to a kind of process psychology. The going is the goal. The wandering life is not about finding permanence, securing a beachhead against change or insecurity. Rather, movement is the physiological substrate of the paradoxical experience of embracing life as it presents itself, rather than exclusively through the filters of myth and ritual, which are mistakenly taken to be, in a sedentary societies, the fundamental sources of aliveness. So, the last thing that popped up, I have to start with something, because it's really, there's just so much in all of this. I think I more than dabbled in shamanism. I pretended to be a shaman. I acted as if I was a shaman for a period of time and got heavily into ceremonies and rituals and all that stuff. And I think I was quite a charismatic kind of guy as well. And that was the period in Guatemala where that was central to this tribe building that I was involved in. And there's loads I could say about that, but just trying to stay on the text somewhat. In the years after, after I turned 40, where I was withdrawing interest from all that kind of stuff, I still did occasional rituals but they were much more impulsive and organic and spontaneous, I should say. And it occurred to me that actually what I was doing with these ceremonies, there was nothing causal in it at all. And what it was to do with was me enacting something that would allow my conscious mind to perceive something that was already underway in the unconscious. So I had mistaken an effect for a cause, in other words. So say, just using an easy example, I never did ceremonies for rain, needless to say, but we'll just go to the most easy example. You know, if a tribe or a shaman does this ceremony to create rain, or thinks is really the rain is already on its way, and the intimation and the intuition of the coming rain is what moves the shaman to harmonize with it, to synchronize with it, so that he is also embodying the energy of the rain as the rain, you know, is coming into embodiment. So he's being sympathetic and cooperative, but there's no causative power that the shaman has. It's receptive, and I'm not saying this for a fact, and I'm not Mercier Eliade, I'm just using that as an example of what I perceived in my own experience. Oh, I thought I was kind of harnessing this power to help facilitate results that I wanted to bring about. And later on I rejected that. No, that's magic self-will, I don't want to do it. But then when I realized, or I started to see, well, ceremony does occasionally still have a place in my life, so am I being a hypocrite? Part of that, looking more closely at it, was realizing that I'd got it completely ass backwards, and that I had tried to take credit for something and tried to assign agency to myself in a way that was not humble, let's say, that was aggrandizing. And I think this is really central to this whole thesis of Berman's and the passages we just read. I mean, it's one of many things that are central, I'd say, is that there was a certain point, there was an assumption of, and it's more than an assumption, it's a grabbing, it's a seizing of credit for something that was much more cooperative. And so then there was an assumption of power by the aggrandizers, which then translated through charisma to the community, so that they also began to see the shaman as this powerful figure, rather than, as in the earlier understanding, merely what were the words for the chieftain? Oh, had an obligation. So let's say with the rain thing, the shaman somehow is there as a barometer to indicate when rain is coming. That's an obligation. He's not creating the rain, but there's something in that ability that makes him receptive, where he can embody the energy of the rain and let everybody know that the rain is coming, let's say. So that's an obligation. There's no power in it at all. He's actually just a vessel for something.
Right, so it sounds like the key of a shaman, if you had to define it now, would be certainly receptivity. And if I could go back to something I mentioned the last time we talked about Young Guns, the movie, the lost scene. So when Chavez takes the peyote, the psychedelic, he's not doing so as the, at least one would read it on the surface, he's not doing it in the sense of I alone possess this power. It's rather, we have a problem, so let me tap in and be receptive to whatever the spirit world is telling me, because we need to extract ourselves from our current state. And he does that definitely not in a sense of self-aggrandizement, but more receptivity, because we want to solve this problem and get on our way.
And even the idea that a shaman might be a healer, now that does suggest a kind of power that's a bit more glamorous, and that does have a causative, the shaman actually does things. Even that idea, if one starts to experience it, is not at all glamorous, because the shaman that I apprenticed under, if I can even talk in these terms anymore, but anyway, that was how I felt at the time, Mitch. He from very early on, he was very clear about the shaman is just like the garbage man. That's his job. He takes out the garbage. It's the last job anyone would want. Now,
pedestrian.
And getting your hands dirty. I mean, actually, ironically, running a thrift store is probably closer to truly shamanic than when I was smoking DMT and lighting candles and invoking deities back in Guatemala, because really I'm just constantly processing and recycling crap.
So the funny thing is that you really true have realized you got it ass backwards. You're more of a shaman now than back then.
Well, yeah, at least it's certainly cleaner and healthier and doing less damage, because there's no doubt that this was apparent in Guatemala, because the Western view of shaman is glamorized. That had also corrupted the culture there in Guatemala, because of course there's all these tourists there who are throwing money around and they want to become shamans. And so of course that brings the charlatan out of the shamans that are there and allows charlatans to pretend to be shamans and so on and so forth. So the whole kind of the resonance or the frequency of shamanic service has been totally compromised, and I was attracted to it by Castaneda, which is all about the quest for power, and it really isn't like that. I guess that's all I have to say about that. The unity of trance thing, I think, is really an important point as well. I like to maybe probe a bit into that, because we still have some time.
Sure. Well, before you get to that, there was something I wanted to comment on in the passage about the ambulatory aspect. So what popped to mind as you were reading that, and when I read this initially, is about meditation. So there's the sitting meditation to quiet the mind and focus on one's body and one's breath to unlock the secrets, if we could use that language. On the other hand, there are traditions within Buddhism that has a walking meditation, or even motion, focusing on maybe your steps or focusing on maybe a destination, or just you have a diffuse awareness as you're moving of your surroundings, much like a hunter-gatherer would be. So I know in particular the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, way back in the 90s when he was starting to get popular, had talked about walking meditation. And, you know, I've been pretty lazy over the years of maintaining a meditative practice. I tried when I was younger, and then I fell away from it. But I would lean more towards a walking meditation than the sitting meditation, just because I would like to be in motion. And then understanding what we've read here about bourbon is that I like it better because it just allows me to suspend my mind and just hopefully I'm trying to become more of the surroundings instead of I'm sitting there really working hard to try to quiet my mind and focusing on something so I can unlock the keys there. I would much rather just be in motion. That's me.
Yeah, same. I feel meditation is overrated and possibly ill-advised. Partly a combination of my own loss of interest in it with Dave O'Shaughnessy's reservations about it, because he feels that trying to control your mind or quieten your thoughts is futile, but the mind will always do what it does. He says he's enlightened, but his mind still does what it does. He just doesn't confine himself to it and give too much attention to it. And also, as a related point, that thinking is, the mind is part of the body, let's say. I mean, that's what I how I understand it. So thoughts themselves are generated by the body, and that they may well, thinking may be like off-gassing, you know, like indigestion. Like if we have indigestion, well, we might take Pepto-Bismol, but the thing is, we just take care about what we eat next time. We don't try and stop the digestive system. We just say, okay, it's slightly out of whack. And I think that the same thing is true of the mind. It's you know, it gets too agitated and all these stupid thoughts are coming up. I think if we try and control them, we just kind of feed that mechanism by giving it attention, whereas if we just let it do its thing. And actually, I mean, when I walk, and I walk as a daily thing, it's almost a discipline, but I mean, I just make the effort to do that, to walk in nature. I often do think the whole time, and it's a bit of a shame at the end of the walk. I realize I haven't noticed much because I was in my head. But on the other hand, well, at least I gave my mind a chance to off gas, you know. And that was how meditation was for me. It was a time where I could just, I would just notice, my God, my mind, it just won't stop.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to actually stop it.
Yeah. It's hard. It's really hard. Even when I tried to do it, sitting meditation back in my 20s, it was really hard to quiet the mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and it may not be natural.
No.
That's the thing.
No, I don't think it is. And in fact, you know, Dave O'Shaughnessy, it's an important point, because meditation is so wrapped up in Buddhist practice, but actually that's not the case in the early days. Meditation was not central to ancient Buddhism. It's more central to Zen, Zazen, sitting meditation, certain schools of Buddhism, but not across the board. There are still those sects that don't place a whole lot of attention on meditation. It's on other things.
And again, we may be trying to get back to a state that we've lost for neurotic reasons, and that it's impossible. We can't really go back in this life. There is no way to go backwards. One can stand still and then one will regress, you know, just because one's standing still. But that's not the equivalent, needless to say. And so I wonder, I mean, one thing that had already occurred to me about this ambulatory existence is, you know, movement, life in movement, how that relates to existing in the womb, because in the womb one is in water, so there is constant movement around one, but also one is inside the mother's body, which is a lot of the time would be moving. So in those first 9 months of our life, a lot of the time we're being moving around inside the mother's body, so the rhythms of walking would actually be part of our gestation. That's one thing that occurred to me. And now around meditation, well, so of course fetuses don't think. They don't hardly perceive in the way that we do. They certainly, they don't have objective perception. They don't perceive a world of objects, and they certainly don't have an internal dialogue. So we may, I think that there's so much of the spiritual quest and the will to power, and they're very closely related, interconnected, and of course the pursuit of happiness, seem to be symptomatic of this pathological drive to get back to the womb and repossess the mother's body and or be repossessed by it. And this is the unitive trance too, it seems to me, that there's a kind of unitive trance that's natural, which would sit, well, it wouldn't be a trance, I suppose, but would, I guess, would relate to this being in the paradox of unfocused awareness and focused. So we're aware of being an individual, but physically, but we're also submerged in the existence, horizontally submerged, including the other members of our band. So we're part of this band. So that's a kind of unitive state without any trance being necessary, perhaps. I mean, we might look at it as a trance from a totally, individualized consciousness, but that's again looking back, as compared to the unhealthy attempt to get into a unitive state through trance, through ritual, and through projection and transference onto charismatic figures, which maybe corresponds with this unhealthy maternal attachment.
Yeah, what came to mind reading that was a nationalistic sense. Or right. Being at a political rally. But then again, maybe right. One could make the argument that a political rally is somewhat natural in a slightly unnatural sense, because if you're chanting, or a better example would be at a sports game, yeah. A football match or a hockey match or something like that, you are in a unit of trance with the other fans.
Yeah, and well, then hate week and the 1984.
Right, or the two-minute hate. Yeah, that's the unhealthy.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, we're almost finished. So if I could go ahead and read my remaining passages.
Okay, which page?
Okay, so at the bottom of page 61, I'll just go through all of them.
Wait, 61?
Sorry, 81.
81, okay.
Okay, so Berman says, the truth is that we have never cut the cord connecting ourselves to animal alertness, because that cord is part of us and probably part of the circuitry of the brain. Not all intent or futurizing is bad, of course. We would hardly be human without it. The problem arose when the quick kill, the narrow focus, was consistently chosen over the expanded peripheral one. The effect is destructively synergistic because everyone else is forced into similar behavior in order to survive. Thus, delayed return systems probably, the SAC, the Sacred Authority Complex, culture, civilization, and power politics, social inequality, all arise at roughly the same time and accelerate rapidly. In a cultural sense, they get naturally selected for. So the, quote, ascent of man, in Jacob Bronowski's perhaps unfortunate phrase, is the story of increasing intent, futurizing, and the suppression of alternative forms of awareness and behavior. Continuing. It is for this reason that when civilization finally does destroy or sedentize the handful of remaining hunter-gatherers, the victors will, ironically enough, prove to be losers as well. To live like this is to live on shaky ground, for the historical record is absolutely clear in this. Civilizations are inherently unstable. They do not last, although some have obviously had a very long runs. Thus, the dilemma is clear enough. For one way of interpreting the record of repeated civilizational collapse is to say that on a logarithmic curve, planning depth, or what has also been called hypercoherence, finally does itself in. This is why contemporary calls for religious renewal that argue for the resurrection of myth, transcendence, or ecstatic experience are ultimately pseudo-solutions. For they can trap us in more verticality, perpetuating a game of heresy versus orthodoxy that we have been playing for millennia.
Right, okay. Continues. In control contexts such as exist among some hunter-gatherers and small tribal cultures, this might make some sense. Within an industrialized context, the typical result is the generation of authoritarian regimes.
So it's a doubling down. As collapse is occurring. That's how we read that.
Yeah. I was thinking about groupthink as well, because you... and how they're essential to authoritarian regimes. And there seems to be a correspondence between the hierarchical, vertical, social systems that have charismatic leaders that we project onto, and groupthink, whether it's nationalism or cults or whatever else, that the way in which we enter into a unitive trance and feel connected to each other, this is the counterfeit, isn't it? Is through a shared allegiance to something outside of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where the leader, the priest or the shaman or the demagogue comes in.
Mm-hmm. Or even just within the context of the sporting event, is both teams and the fans are in a unitive trance, united amongst themselves, but allied against the other.
So when did you start reading philosophy then?
When I was 17. That was my first philosophy class.
So a little over 30 years of reading and studying philosophy.
Yeah.
And would you say that that knowledge, that kind of knowledge, has led to self-knowledge and possibly to wisdom?
Well, I don't want to be so conceited to say I'm wise. I think that comes with age somewhat, but it's certainly, I mean, I make no bones about telling people those that I will be the one to say I've read bits and pieces of the major works over the years, and I've relied a little bit on summaries too, just because I don't have the time to actually read through the actual text. But it's also circular. So I start at one point and then go around, and then I return to that same point, but I'm at a higher level. So it's after reading, popping back and forth here and there, and then over time you start to see connections and overlap. And I mean, it's not a concerted effort. It's a concerted effort to read, but it's not a concerted effort to read just one figure or one school, because then I would become an academic, which is something I chose not to do years ago. You become hyper-specialized in just one thing, cranking out paper after paper after paper, and then you lose your original enthusiasm for what you started off doing. So I just kept it up as an amateur while doing other things. And then, you know, it certainly provides you with the background where, just like in Berman's book here on Chapter 6, yeah, I've read some of Wittgenstein, so I know the themes that he's getting at, because I've read that, versus somebody who's just here, just like, well, I know nothing about Wittgenstein. I can't make heads or tails of what he's saying. Well, I can, because I know a bit of the background and I've read it before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, one Berman gets at a lot of anthropology, which I'm not an expert in, but I do know a little bit about Jung. I know a little bit about Horney and Freud and all the rest of the psychoanalysts that he quotes in there. So I have some exposure to that.
Right. So were you on the trail of something as you were reading? Like, did one thing lead to another, as if you were following a thread? Or were you, was it a more formal kind of discipline of just trying to get familiar with major work?
Some of that, but also was, I guess probably the best way is, there was this one book that I bought recently. This is by Michel Mayor, who is a French philosopher. The name of the book, I have it on my hands here, is called Of Problematology. So it's framing problems and asking lots of questions as you go through. And I just found myself you don't have an end goal, really. You've asked a question, you come up with an answer, and then that opens up five other questions, and then you follow those threads. But as long as you, I think some philosophers have said this, as long as you adopt the stance of always questioning, never resting fully,
mm-hmm.
just kind of like keeping in motion, you know, hunter-gatherer, is the more questions you ask, the less knowledge you claim to have, but under the surface you gain more of an understanding, I think.
Right, that was what I was trying to get to, because there's a platitude that the more you learn, the less you know.
Yeah.
There are various different ways to say it. But I found that to be true, and we touched on that last time around David Sharner, that I was just wondering if the amount of knowledge that you've, how do I put it? I mean, it is in that platitude that gathering knowledge over time reveals that it's not really knowledge, as in it doesn't allow one to know very much,
right,
all the knowledge in the world.
There's no way you can know everything, but certainly the benefits that I've gleaned from it is a greater appreciation of the subject, a greater appreciation of the connections among things, and it certainly has sharpened my bullshit detector in certain areas. You know, for example, is I never was attracted to a guru, unlike some people. Now, why is that? Well, given what we've discussed and what you've discussed before, I never was primed to seek out a guru. I maybe was primed to ask questions, and to do my own seeking. But I was, but then I also became somewhat comfortable with paradox, and that there is a paradox in following a guru, because you believe that the guru possesses all of the knowledge that you care to know that would unlock certainty. But what is certainty? Type of thing. But that kept me. But that kept me away from gurus. Those things.
Well, you're presenting that as an unqualified positive, I think. As in, you're making gurus synonymous with untrustworthy charismatics, or I think.
Yeah, it might be slightly unfair, but isn't that what often pops into people's minds when you talk about a guru? Who would ever follow a guru? Who in their right mind would do that?
Well, it depends who you're talking with, because I know people who've, you know, lots of people who follow gurus.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I always thought I was very averse to that model. But, you know, I ended up, you know, unwittingly. Like, does that extend for you into not having icons at all, do you think?
Hard to say. I'm sure I do, at least part of the time.
Because, I mean, I guess we're winding up, but, and we can continue this later, but perhaps, but this whole question of knowledge, my sense is, and I think maybe you were touching on when you said it increases your bullshit detector, that we live in a world that worships knowledge. It's actually considered to be Luciferian. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but anyway, it has been equated with Luciferianism, the worship of knowledge, and so we live in a world where knowledge is the primary currency. It's not really recognized. People think it's money or even power, but
right.
I'd say even subtler level, it's knowledge, and that's consistent with the you know, the book of Genesis, this idea that knowledge was the original sin,
mm-hmm.
which Nietzsche sort of made fun of, like science, just science meaning knowledge, and that the original sin was to know. But anyway, leaving Nietzsche aside, the older I get, the more truth I see in that. Not that knowledge itself is a bad thing, or that it's inherently corrupting, but the idea that somehow gathering knowledge, or even, you know, original knowledge, perhaps, gives us the idea that somehow we need knowledge to survive, or that knowledge will empower us, or knowledge will make us somehow better. And it's, of course, one has to have enough knowledge to be very selective and discerning about what one chooses to know or believe one knows. Is an even subtler distinction, isn't it?
Sure. Could add, it's also a conceit. So what you just said there are also things that have passed through my mind over the years, where no one can know everything. So knowledge, yes, could have been the original sin, but you can't survive without knowledge. I mean, you have to know where to go find the yummy plants, or where the predators are. That counts as knowledge, one could say. But I think it's also a synthesis of knowledge that happens, particularly if you read widely. Although I've read quite a bit in philosophy, it's not had been my only avocational focus over the years. I've also read widely in history, I've read in sociology, I've read in psychology. You know, in the past couple of years about sexual abuse, that's fairly new to me. I really haven't gotten too much into, as I said, anthropology or even the occult. You know, the occult is somewhat new to me, and I approach it cautiously because I had that same caution way back when. And I think a lot of that was informed by my Christian upbringing. So, you know, we talked the one time about the Satanic Bible, you know, so there was a part of me that's saying, how can anybody take this seriously? But there was another part of me that was saying, stay away from it. Don't get involved in this, because this is going to lead you down the path of destruction, quite possibly.
So you were taking it seriously also.
Yes, taking it seriously to push it aside. I just don't want to get involved with this.
Yeah.
But now that I'm older, and there's been more scholarly treatments on magic and witchcraft and the occult and things like that, I can approach it from how I've been primed over the years to look at it as an interesting and a somewhat serious field of inquiry where, okay, so you're reading somebody like John Dee. He was of a certain time and he was engaged in certain things, and you can look at it a little bit more holistically instead of, you know, John Dee had the key to all knowledge that way. Or even coming into the 20th century, you know, I probably would have felt the same way reading Castaneda, although I could, I think I flipped through Castaneda before and I would have been like, ah, this is one of those, how can anybody take it seriously type things. But that's just me.
I'd be surprised, because it's very literate.
Yeah.
It's high level literature, I would say.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, very accomplished writing and philosophically. It's too late to recommend it, except as a researcher, but Journey to Ixalan, for example. I mean, there seems to be a lot of wisdom in those books.
But I guess the difference there is that you can read it for its insights, but you don't have to swallow it book like a sinker.
Well, no, absolutely. But one wouldn't want to do that with any book, would one?
No.
Unless one's going to become a Christian.
Yes.
Or already is, and then it's kind of part of the deal, isn't it?
That's right. Then you have circular reason, and you have attained certainty. So you think.
Yeah. Well, faith. I mean, faith is, yeah. Is, what is that? Faith is that true certainty, or is that the willingness to live without certainty?
I'd say it's the latter. Kierkegaard certainly would have said the latter.
Right, so that's...
A leap of faith.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, if we'd be a poor Christian, and I've noticed that, I mean, I've heard Christians say that if you can't be sure about anything if you're a Christian.
Yeah, you have to accept it on faith. Although, you know, depending on which strand of Christianity you're talking with, the Bible could be the inerrant God. You take it literally, which I certainly could never have swallowed. And I certainly wasn't taught that when I was in Catholic school. No, nobody that I would talk with, even the nuns, would have said, oh, no, we don't take the Bible literally. You're a damn fool if you did that.
But they wouldn't ever take it just as a book either.
No. So maybe there was some balance there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's every so often I have to sit down and think, you know, what was it that, you know, also based on things that you had said, is that what primed me to go down this path? What primed me to keep it going, except for that I just find this subject utterly fascinating, as I do what Bergman has to talk about here. And just it's a sense of curiosity. And it really irks me even to this day how many people are not only self-aware, but they're just incurious. They don't care to know.
Because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, exactly. Better off just being a sheep, retreat into dullardism. Show me the way.
Well, yeah, for a human being, I mean, this is a conundrum, isn't it? Because we can't actually go back, or if we ever were in an animal state, but certainly a pristine infant state, let's say.
Yeah.
We can't go back to that. We can't go back to existing pre-knowledge and existing without knowledge, purely instinctive, short of becoming feral. But as you say, even if you're feral, you need knowledge about which berries and what not to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a continuum between instinct and knowledge, which it would be hard for us to say. Like, we don't have the ability to rely on our instincts generally anymore, right. So we've had to replace instinctive knowing with more kind of head knowledge, memory-based knowledge, you might even say. And I think that's led to this kind of system where knowledge has become a currency, and the more I have, the better. And that in itself makes knowledge... I mean, like occultism, to me, one of the key differences of occultism, it seems to be, is it's about knowledge as power, not just knowledge out of curiosity. So it's like... gathering knowledge with a specific purpose in mind, like steps, you know, you need this, like joining a cult, in fact.
Right.
You've got to take these steps to get to this level. The Tower of Babylon comes to mind there. whereas I find that knowledge is actually quite a burden, and that in a certain sense, like with maybe with Hollywood movies, I'm trying to satiate myself with knowledge. I'm trying to get enough to bring a kind of coherence to my life. Yes, there's this need to make things more coherent, whether it's Whitley Strieber or Crowley or whoever. Mm-hmm. But as well as that, or consistent with that, to just satiate myself with knowledge and just, okay, I realize I can't possibly know everything. So at a certain point, I'm just going to have to stop trying to, learn more and more, thinking that somehow I'll actually be happier if I know more stuff, because it doesn't seem to be the case.
No, it could also be, my reading habits are sometimes just the pleasure of the activity. Yeah. Not really that I'm gleaning anything. And that's also where a paradox comes in, because you could take a non-focused approach to things, just reading passages and flipping through and scanning, and you're not reading from cover to cover in a purposeful, concerted manner. But then you're surprised a couple of years later when you've actually picked up on some things that you were not aware of, or that what you had was stored, and then things that you've read since then subsequently just fit very neatly into that. It's very strange. It's hard for me to explain, but I've noticed that many times over my life.
Yeah. No, I think I have an experience like that in terms of, I think it's about knowledge being somehow holographic, that if we know enough about a given subject, for me, for example, movies, we develop a kind of mastery over that subject. And so then it becomes a lens through which we can see other things as
right.
well.
And that's where where I was getting at with my bullshit detector, is that the lens is in place, sort of subconsciously, and it's sharpened over time against consciously. And if you're presented with something, you instinctively know that it's bullshit or that's harmless, and that you stay away from it. Whereas somebody who is not as practiced in that will fall for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, so because I think for me, knowledge is very much like working on a mystery, and it's honing the deductive faculties, the ability to recognize anomalies, inconsistencies, leads and clues.
Right.
Whatever it is, doesn't really matter. And so it's like panning for gold or mining, digging for gold. Once one's developed that tool set, then one can let go of all the knowledge around it. I don't really need to remember all this stuff about movies.
Right.
It's just that was the clay that I learned to sculpt with.
Right.
And now I can work in other mediums.
Yeah, it's tacit knowledge. It's something
right.
that you've absorbed in yourself. You've gone through it enough where you don't have to articulate the steps to go through it, all right? So I need to do this first and do this second and do this third. It's something that's automatic as you go through. Instinctively, you know what to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like returning to instinct.
Yeah.
Changes in the heart, change with the times, strangers in the night.
That's the end of the second part, my conversation with Tim Kay on The Wandering God. There will be a third part, possibly a fourth, not sure how long it will continue, as long as my interest remains piqued. Though I will be travelling soon, so all kinds of things will be suspended as a result. It's only for a week, but then there's preparations and recoveries and all that kind of stuff too. Next week's podcast will be with Monsieur Martin Joly, and will be very different than before. Cannot listen to the same limitless podcast twice.
Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart change with the times. persist. All the letdowns and wins, the things you begin with, the things that you end with, changes in the heart change with the times. Changes in the stars change with the night.